Session number 26579.
Mr. Clark, Reel 11. We're talking about these three-day jungle patrols that used to go out under the command of Sergeant Brown, who was your company commander, although he was a sergeant.
No, he was your patrol commander.
Patrol.
The company commander was Major McKinnon.
Ah, sorry, I missed
He started off initially to get us... You know.
Right, I've got that now. So, what you were, we're talking about the uniform, the equipment carried. Now, what about weapons? What weapons would you carry?
Well, the weapons were designed, obviously, for jungle warfare. We had the 303 rifle, but it was converted. It was cut short, in actual fact. It was a very, very small version of the old 303 rifle. It was cut right down, and it had a flash eliminator as well, similar to the Bren gun. It was, I think it was called a Mark III rifle. I think it was a Mark III rifle, but it was virtually the old Lee MP rifle cut down with a flash eliminator in the end.
Now, did that affect but its very, accuracy? Or
no,
any?
It did not. I was just about to say that. Its accuracy was still the same, very accurate. It was, also, as I say, it was designed for close quarter combat, and so that also to allow us to move through the jungle without getting snagged up. With all weapon would have done. We still had the Bren gun. We still had grenades. In fact, we carried each about four of us. Each carried about four grenades each, and the Sten gun. Now we had this, a silencer for the Sten gun, but I never. You find it. You could. It was quite optional what weapon you carried there. They didn't mind which weapon you carried as long as you carried an effective weapon. And the first time I went on patrol with the Sten gun with the silencer attached, I refused to take it anymore.
Now, why was
that? The silencer was massive. It was a massive, big piece of equipment fitted onto the end of the Sten gun. And it didn't have a proper sling hold. So, as a consequence, the sling used to keep sliding up and down. And it was such a pest. So, when I got back off my first patrol, I told Major McKinnon, my company commander, that I didn't think this was conducive to a combat. It'd be a hindrance rather than an asset combat, and he agreed with me. So thereafter I didn't take a silencer. But I don't think any of us did it finish up. Because as I said to Mrs. McKinnon at the time as well, I said, well, if I've got to fire a Sten gun, sir, I said, the guy's gonna be very close to me. I said, it won't make any difference, but I said, right enough, yeah. So that was apart from that, the weapons were virtually the same as you would in a normal. They say the only difference being the Enfield rifle cut down.
Now, what did
the rifle also had a rubber butt. A rubber instead of a brass butt plate or a steel butt plate, it had a rubber butt plate. Simply because this, with the barrel being shorter, the recoil was greater. So they fitted the rubber butt to avoid any injuries to the shoulder. And it was a lovely little weapon to fire. I used to enjoy firing it. So we went out the first time for 3 days, and as I said, the company commander, we got off at this, laid us off from this grid reference, and then he led us at the end of 3 days to another grid reference where transport was waiting to pick us up. Now, I must say at this stage that we were using maps of 1928 vintage. Now, there was a big furore about this among the military in Malaya, but for some reason the powers that be didn't seem to grasp the message. So the company commander explained to us that the patrols would have to be very, very local, in as much as that, because of this, if we went too far, we might never get back again because of the inaccuracy of the maps. But to go back to the first patrol, we spotted nothing. But it was really...
Now, what formation would you adopt? Tell me.
We, went in single file. Now, a very interesting point here is this. I'm glad you brought this up. Very interesting point here was, before we went on patrol, everyone was stripped of their rank. You didn't wear your badge of rank. Officers took their pips off. We took our stripes down. Officers were and NCOs didn't lead. We had to stay in the middle. Let's have a patrol. So it meant, in effect, one man had to lead the patrol, and that was known as a leading scout. Now, in my section, my leading scout was a guy called Willie McLaughlin, whose name we shall hear of later on. Now, Willie was the next Navy man. He had spent, I think, 10 years in the Navy and then came out and joined the Army. So Willie McLaughlin was our leading scout. Now, what used to happen is...
Now, would he always do it, or would you take it in turns?
No, he had to be specialised in it. They had to get so used to it, because it was a very, very responsible position in the patrol.
And he was just a private?
A rifleman, that's right. He was just a rifleman.
Rifleman.
So, what happened was this. McLaughlin would go out in front, and the second man would always have to be in sight of him. In fact, we all had to be in sight of each other. Not too close up, but keep each other in sight. Now, if McLaughlin spotted something that he wasn't happy about, he'd put his hand up to halt the patrol. He would then think, well, what is it? Is it the enemy or what? And he'd decide what to do. If he felt that the situation was a bit fraught, dangerous, he would signal for me to come up. I was the next NCO. I'd be about the third or fourth back, with a sergeant and the officer behind me. I would go forward, and he'd say, I think, whisper very, very low. Like, you know, I mean, I could hear him then. And I would then have to make a decision. And that was it. And this is why I emphasised earlier on, this was a section commander's war. The corporals had to make the decisions. And we had various hand signals that we used. As I said,
but between you all,
we all knew the hand signals.
Tell me about them.
If you spotted the enemy, you gave a thumbs. You put your arm out full extent, thumbs down. If you thought the enemy was there, then it wasn't there. Then you give a thumbs up. That was a signal for patrol to carry on. Now then, if we came into an open piece of ground, and was quite, sometimes this happened, an open piece of solid ground. You would then go into open formation, or arrowhead formation, whatever. Extended line arrowhead. And if you wanted the Bren gun on the right-hand flank, say for example you were going in arrowhead formation, you would then give the signal an arrow shape above your head so that everybody in the patrol could see it, or they would pass it back. You'd come forward, and then you would give a signal with your upper arm extended and your forearm pointed towards the heavens with your fist clenched, which meant that was for the Bren group to go to the right or to the left. If it was going to the left hand, if you wanted to go to the right hand. It was the upper arm extended, pillow to the ground, the forearm point towards the heavens, the clenched fist, and then you'd point, and the Bren group, the NCO in charge of the Bren group, would get in that flank, and then the patrol would line up. If you were going back into the jungle again, then it was a question of signal.
Just putting
single
your
file. The arm straight up and down, pointing forward and back, and the patrol would close back in behind you. So it was essential that only in very, very rare occasions did someone come up and have to whisper into your ear or you whisper into their ear. But in the main, in the signalling, once everybody got to know the signalling routine, it became very effective. So that 3 days was invaluable, as far as we were concerned.
Now, you'd go along, how long would you march for before you had a break? You know, march, how long would you go?
Well, that's a good question, actually. Simply because at that time, and in fact, at any time, we saw very little daylight. The jungle was so dense. And any daylight that filtered through would usually finish about 3 o'clock. in the afternoon.
So tell me how dense the jungle was, because I can't really picture it.
In some parts were just like virtually going through a wall. I mean, you had trees there 200 feet high, plus the undergrowth.
Now, did you go on paths or did you cut your way through?
No, we were taught at the jungle school, don't cut your way through. Some people did cut their way through, but this wasn't a very, very good thing. Simply because if you started cutting things down, other things fell on top of your head. In our company, we devised this system of using our hands rather than a machete. We were armed by big machetes. And we would just part with our hands, we would part the foliage and go through that way.
And you're making a gesture almost like swimming, you know.
Exactly, just like a swimming motion. And you found it was very, very effective. And it was silent. That was the other big thing about it, it was silent.
Now, how important was it to be silent?
It's very important to be silent, because in the jungle, you noise carried quite a way. So it was important you be very, very silent. So I think we virtually used this first patrol, three-day patrol.
Hang on, a couple more questions. I know I'm holding you back there, but what would you sort of progress for? I mean, would you do an hour on, 10 minutes off, almost like a route march, or you know, would you have breaks?
No, we did have breaks, but very, 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 very short breaks. For the simple reason, we had to cover as much ground as we could in a very short space of time.
So speed was also important.
Not, it wasn't terribly important speed, by virtue of the fact that a patrol, we'd go out and patrol, say we dropped off at 10 o'clock in the morning. The patrol would finish at 3, because darkness would start to roll in.
So you'd stop?
We'd stop, try and find a piece of decent ground. And if you're in a swamp, you had to get out of the swamp.
How did you bivouac overnight then?
We didn't. We just lay. What happened is, in our packs, these huge big packs, we had a clean set of jungle greens, a shirt and a pair of slacks. When we eventually got set up to stay the night in a certain spot, we would take off the stuff we'd been wearing, because this time it was absolutely saturated. Shirt, and then also you had to get the boots off and get the leeches out of your leg. You used to be crawling with leeches. And the only way you could get them off was by lighting a cigarette up and burning them off. You couldn't swipe them off. Otherwise, you'd knock the body off and infect your legs. So, we had this to do. And you then drag yourself down with a towel as much as possible, put on your clean gear, and that was you for the night. Lie down wherever you could. We had a ground sheet. Put your ground sheet on the deck, rolled up ground sheet and a blanket. One blanket and a ground sheet, and rolled up at the bottom of the pack, put that down, and that was it for the night. Then the next morning, up you would get your breakfast with little Tommy cookers. It was little tablets things on a little wire triangular thing. And we'd mess tins, and we'd cook whatever sausage or whatever it was in mess tins, and eat hardtack biscuits. And
the only food you'd have, really?
That's all you had, really, yeah. And tins of soup.
Self-heating, or...?
No. It was cold. You used to sup it cold. Or if you could get your... warmed on the little stove, we could do that. But very rarely would time to do that. So, as I say, life was very, very Spartan.
Now, what about the creepy, crawly side of it? You mentioned leeches. Can you tell us a bit more about it?
I'm going to tell you something. I was more scared of the creepy crawlies and the wildlife than what I was with the terrorists. Absolutely, I was absolutely terrified of snakes. Rats and snakes are two things, even today. When a rat landed here on this floor, I'd be first out that door. But, no, it was quite a... It was quite frightening, especially at night time. You could be lying there and something would be crawling over you. You didn't know what it was, but you just had to lie still. And it wasn't very pleasant at all. The nightlife wasn't very good. We did see quite a few snakes, and eventually we did see quite a few apes. monkeys and apes and things. They were around us all the time, like, you know.
But some of the snakes were pretty deadly, I would imagine.
Yeah, you'd never see a deadly type of snake on Earth there. I remember being in an ambush position once, and there was a python wrapped around a tree about 5 feet away from me. And I couldn't move, because by the time I discovered the snake, this ambush had been set up, and it was more than my life was worth the daring. But eventually this guy unwrapped himself from the tree and went off in another direction. So I was quite relieved. Then they had these snakes, what they called banded crates. Banded crates. Banded crate. K-R-A-I-T-S. They were vicious and were very deadly. And they...
You mean they'd actually go for you?
Oh, they would go for you,
yeah. Snakes go run away, don't they?
No, a snake... But if you got... on one occasion, one of our chaps, he almost trod in this bandit crate. And what happened was, it attacked him. But fortunately, it hit the side of his jungle boot. It was glancing off his boot. Had it caught him full on, it would have killed him. And he's firing his stem gun at it, never hit it, the thing got away.
So, anything else about the patrols? I mean, the first patrol, nothing happened.
Nothing happened. No, it was pretty.
You wouldn't have a change of uniform the second night, I presume.
Well, when we get back to camp, we would change. We just put our uniforms in for the laundry to the laundry, and Charlie Company, we had a massive big bath. Don't know how we managed to get a massive bath. We could get about 20 guys in it. It was just like one of these communal footballers' baths in the olden days. And as soon as we got all our gear off, we'd jump into that and have a good bath. Then got on the clean gear, with a few beers in the canteen at night, and we'll have a good meal first, and then a few beers. Now, when you come back to camp, there's always two patrols out and one patrol in to do the internal security and fatigues, peeling spuds and what have you. There's always two patrols out.
So two jungle patrols, 2 3-day patrols would be out.
Yeah, that was to start with. But then eventually they built up. By the time I left, we were doing anything up to 2-week patrols. In fact, we finished up, I believe we were doing two-month patrols. The Dakota aircraft dropping supplies to them. The longest I did, actually, was a month. And they...
Well, that's so you'd be back at camp,
yep.
And you'd have your bath, and you were wired in. You were wired in.
That's right, completely wired in. Then at night the guard would be, these patrols would be taken off, and then a guard would be supplied, a guard commander, corporal, lance corporal, there were 8 guys to do the night patrol, while the day guys got their head down. It was a simpler, everything was just routine. Everything, it was organisation, excellent organisation, the running of this camp. Now, one incident happened just shortly after we were told to watch the civvy staff. We had 1 or 2 civilians worked in the camp. They were in a special little room.
And were they Chinese or Malayan?
Chinese, Malayans, mainly Chinese, in actual fact.
And how did you get on with them? What were they,
We got on all right with them. I was guard commander one night, and I was visiting this. This was shortly after I got into Malaya. And anyway, the brigade commander came up for a conference. The colonel came up for a conference with the CO and the company officers. An operation was in the offing. And when I'd just finished checking the patrols, paying a visit to the patrols, and I knew this conference was taking place in the company commander's office. And I happened to see this figure, a shadowy figure, and he was against the door, with his ear to the door, listening. And you could hear the voices, in actual fact, because the building was quite, the woodwork was quite thin. And I watched this guy for about 5 minutes, and I thought, this guy's up to no good. So what I did was I just ran and grabbed him, put an arm lock on him, flung the door open, flung the guy in, and everybody went, ah, there was gasps all around, Then this guy shouting, "Don't shoot, don't shoot." He thought I was going to shoot him, like, you know. Anyway, it transpired he was a part of what they call the Minyun. It was the terrorist secret service, the spy network, part of the spy network.
And he was Chinese?
He was Chinese.
Oh, or Chinese origin.
Yeah. So what happened was, I had to make a statement as to what happened, how I came on to this guy and what have you. And the police came up, the civil police came up from Moore, and they took him away. And here he was on the suspected list at the police headquarters. So I made my statement, as I said, signed it, off it went. And a week later, a sergeant major sent for me. So that bloke, he said, we captured last week, he said, he was executed this morning. So they did no nonsense. Once they knew he was a spy, they shot him. Well, he was hanged, I believe. So that was it. Now, the spy network was quite good in actual fact, simply because the terrorists, as terrorists are, terrorized the local villages and they terrorized the people into giving them information, giving them money, giving them supplies. It was a dreadful situation for the local population to be in. But later on, that was rectified. And that's another part of the story. But as I say, we...
Whose spy network? The Chinese, the terrorist spy network was good.
They're the spy network based on terror. And they would get as much out of the local villagers as possible. And the village headmen would terrorize the village headmen. And they would watch our movements and send word into the jungle about the movements, like, you know. They've seen a patrol going out, which direction they thought it was going. Very, very basic, but very effective as far as the terrorists were concerned, because they could get the information that they wanted, like, you know. So, anyway, after that first patrol then, we used to go out with Sergeant Brown. He would then, as I say, he was an old hand at jungle warfare from Burma. And an excellent chap. And
tell me a bit about him. Do you know his first name?
He was always known as Danny Brown. He was ex-KSB in actual fact. He was in the King's Own Scottish Borderers. And within the brigading system, as we had at one time, you could jump from one regiment to another, or you could be posted from one regiment to another, depending on the requirements of a regiment.
And what was he like as a bloke?
He was a first-class bloke. He was a typical Scot in many ways. He was kind of dour. And he brooked no nonsense. But underlying that, he had a terrific sense of humour. I think he came from Edinburgh. And he came from around Edinburgh way. And very much respected, simply because he knew his stuff. He came out in front with us and what have you, like, you know. Off parade, pretty nice guy. You could go up to Danny and talk to him, like, you know. And I mean, there was no first names, of course, right enough, but he was a very well-respected man. And in fact, all the senior NCOs in the company were very good. From the company sergeant major, he was an ex-Japanese prisoner of war, John D.L.
John D.L.
D.L. D-A-L Dalziel.
Got it. Dalziel, yeah.
He was a terrific little sergeant major.
What was so good about him?
He had a fantastic sense of humour. He wasn't a barrack square man. He wasn't... I mean, like the one before him, Galbraith, he was a pucker little barrack square sergeant major. Whereas John D.L. was a quite going man, but always got his message through and always got what he wanted, like, you know. And he'd had a terrible time. He was in the hands of the Japanese for 3 years. But you'd never have thought so. He came through it very well. He'd been a tough little sod, you know. So the senior NCOs in the company were very good. But Danny Brown, as I say, was our favourite. He was our boss, and that was it. Eventually, the patrols got longer and longer, like, you know.
Now, how did you make? I mean, in the you said you changed uniform at night. Obviously, you couldn't take too many uniforms with you.
We only took the one. You only had that one dry uniform. But the next morning, what you did was, you went back into the old wet stuff and you put your dry uniform back into the rucksack again. You'd hang the clothes you were wearing before. You'd hang up a tree or something. They would never dry. There was no way they could dry. But you get back into the wet gear the next morning, put your dry stuff away, and then back carry on the patrols. And that was the procedure every day, every night. But it was just to make sure that you're reasonably comfortable during the night with the dry clothing and dry socks on.
So the patrols got longer. Now, nothing happened on the first one. Things did happen, though, didn't they?
eventually, about the third or fourth patrol, I think about the fourth patrol, we had been out for about 4 days, 5 days, and we ran up against the terrorists. And a pretty fierce battle broke out.
Now tell me exactly everything you can remember about it.
Well, what happened was, Willie McLaughlin put his hand up and gave the thumbs down. And I went forward. I said, "What is it, Willie?" He said, "I'm certain there's some bastards in there," he said, "in that the group of undergrowth there," he said. "I'm sure they're waiting for us." Okay, I said, "All right, just hang on." So what I did was, I went back, I whispered in Sergeant Brown's ear what had happened. So then what happened was, I said to Sergeant Brown that I would detour a bit myself, do a little detour and check. And lo and behold, I did see sign of life there, like, no. Come back, and I told Danny. He said, "How many do you reckon it could be?" I said, "Well, it could be any amount." But I said, "Maybe about 6 or 7. And Danny said, "Fuck it, we'll have them. We'll go in and take them." I said, "Okay, fair enough." So all that happened was that you should just tell Willie McLaughlin to up and charge, and we'll be right behind him. And we'll fire, when we think everyone's clear in single file, we'll turn and fire into the undergrowth. And that's what actually happened. And then the next thing was, all hell broke loose. They were there, they'd been expecting us. And a pretty fierce close range firefight broke out. During which, Willie McLaughlin dropped his Sten gun. Oh yeah, he tried, his Sten gun jammed, and he tried to fix it, and he had to drop it, because there was a terrorist lying wounded, trying to get a pin out of a grenade to lob at us. And Willie just dived straight on this guy straight away and strangled him. Killed him completely with his bare hands. And then, don't forget, it's all a blur in my mind. I mean, even today, it's...
What were you doing? I'm blurred.
I fired a guy, and I knew I hit him. I hit this guy.
Now, what should you have? Your Sten without a silence.
There was no need for silence by this time. The battle was on. And I managed to fire and hit this other guy. And then I ran forward and smacked another guy with the butt of my Sten. But by this time, they're starting to go. I reckon there must have been about 10 of them. Anyway, a few seconds later, I heard some terrible noises, and two of my section were killed, a bloke called Holland and Valence. I could hear the bullets, they'd come right up to back me up, and were right beside me, and I could hear the bullets get into them. It was unbelievable. This guy turned around with a Bren gun and fired one burst, and he hit the two of them. And I only got a glancing blow on my chin there, a little scar on my chin. I think it must have been a ricochet or something I got. But these two guys were dead. I could hear the bullets thumping into them, like, you know. But there's no way you could stop. We had to keep going, and they got away, like, you know. What was left of them? Well, it finished up, there was my two lads killed, and four terrorists killed, and me very slightly wounded. And that was it. And what happened was, Danny...